From KMXT and Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes. The cost of lumber and other building materials in Alaska can be sky high, and the pandemic has periodically interrupted the supply chain. One inventive Alaskan wants to make lumber by using locally harvested material no one wants, plastic ocean debris. The EPA has given Patrick Simpson a $100,000 grant to develop his idea of a mobile plastic waste recycler. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin has this story.
Simpson is a fisherman's son who grew up in Cordova. He expected to become a commercial fisherman, too, but the ocean didn't agree with him.
If you have seasickness, you're not going to be a very good fisherman. It just doesn't work out. So I ended up going off to school. I got a degree in engineering at the University of California in San Diego.
Simpson is drawn to the creative lemon into lemonade aspects of engineering, and he's a serial entrepreneur. In the 1990s, he founded a company that made fish counting sonar. After that, he developed an unmanned underwater vehicle. Then Simpson moved into fish waste with a company called Alaska Marine Nutrition.
There, what I did was I went into Cook Inlet and I collected all the fish heads from all the processors and converted them into a food grade fish oil. And sold that in bulk.
He sold that company to his major customer, a Canadian supplements firm. And then one day, he heard a presentation about ghost nets, abandoned fishing nets that float in the oceans, entangling marine mammals and killing fish. The title of the talk was Recycling Fish Nets. Simpson's engineer mind went to work, wondering how the company found them, retrieved them, and then turned them into something useful.
Well, that got me started.
Simpson refocused on plastic waste that washes up on shores all over Alaska and the world. He wants to build a mobile waste recycler that would fit in a 40-foot container or two for easy transport to coastal communities. His current plan is to find material collected in community beach cleanups and intercept it before it goes to a landfill. But plastics recycling is tricky. Plastic isn't one thing. The kind that's used in milk jugs is different than plastic film or rope, and they each have particular properties. Simpson says he can use two major types.
I'm able to take the polyethylene and the polypropylene, and I'm melting those, and then I'm shredding net, nylon, and using it as a reinforcement, the fibers, to create a recycled plastic lumber, and then I'm going to sell that locally.
The lumber isn't suitable for, say, framing a house. Plastic's too bendy for that. But Simpson says it could be made into decking, fencing, or roofing tiles.
The technology's not horribly difficult. It's been proven. And the innovation is the use of the net combined with the melted plastic to create an extruded recycled plastic lumber and the packaging into this mobile platform.
The $100,000 EPA grant is to help improve his concept. If successful, he may be eligible for another EPA grant worth more. And Simpson's not done inventing. He wants to use drones to find which shores have the most plastic debris. That would help direct beach cleanup campaigns, and it would help locate materials Simpson hopes to put to good use. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Skagway Traditional Council is monitoring animal patterns to determine the return of the hooligan into the Upper Lynn Canal. KHNS's Mike Swayze has the story.
The arrival of the hooligan at one time meant the difference between survival and starvation at the end of a long, hard winter in southeast Alaska. Traditionally, hooligan, also known as ulican, candlefish, or sock, provided not only food for the Chilkat and Chilkoot Tlingit people of the Upper Lynn Canal, but also medical, social, and spiritual well-being. Their arrival is often forecasted by the presence of gulls, ducks, seals, sea lions, and orca. Reuben Cash is the environmental coordinator for the Skagway Traditional Council.
What are you working on there? always pick up rocks and look for bugs.
He's also working on the Northern Southeast Alaska Ulacan Population Dynamics Monitoring Program. The purpose of that program is to learn more about these anadromous fish, their ecology, population dynamics, and distribution. For the last 3 to 4 years, the STC has been utilizing a relatively new type of science to study the fish.
We've been using a new methodology using environmental DNA. So every critter has DNA, right? That's what makes up our entire makeup is based on this DNA, and we're constantly shedding our cells. So DNA goes into the environment, so they call it environmental DNA. And you're able to detect whether or not something is there.
Cash says they'll test the waters of the Skagway and Taya Rivers to harvest the environmental DNA samples, which give an accurate picture of the amount of fish that are present.
As they come up these inlets, all the different wildlife follow them. So they call it the grease wave because, you know, it's the hooligan, they're the greasy fish.
Cash says it's not necessarily land animals that he's looking for.
Primarily what I'm looking for is those sea lions, and the mugels are a really, really good indication. So as soon as we start seeing those increase in number, we'll start going into the river and pulling water samples.
A mugel is a variety of gull common to the Upper Lynn Canal region. Between the arrival of those mugels, Arctic terns, seals, and surf scoters, Cash doesn't think it'll be long before the hooligan arrive.
I think it's going to be any day. I'm assuming because there's less than 3,000 mugels over on the flats in Dyea that we don't have hooligan in yet. It's really apparent when they do show up. That place just, it's alive with animals.
In a typical season in Skagway, the hooligan will run into the Skagway and Taya Rivers. In Haines, they will run into the Chilkoot and Chilkat Rivers, but they have been known to inhabit other streams as well. Traditionally, residents of the area would boil fermented hooligan in wooden canoes by adding water and hot rocks. They would then scoop out the oil with ladles after it rose to the top. Year-old oil could be whipped and topped with berries. The fresh oil would be used as a condiment, a dipping sauce, or as medicine to treat arthritis, tuberculosis, or even cancer. These days, people brine and smoke, pickle, fry, bake, or boil them as well. Reporting from Skagway, I'm Mike Swayze.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Madsen. Help Madsen clean up Kodiak on May 8th.
Listen to me, keep your head down. Listen to me, keep your head down.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, which recognizes the importance of Alaska's sustainable fisheries to the state's economy.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their family. AMSEA at AMSEA.org or 907-747-3287.
Alaska is well known for its halibut, cod, salmon, even kelp, destined for the dinner table. But there's one seafood product that may have been made for the CIA, one that you wouldn't want to consume, a lethal toxin used as an alternative to cyanide. Dylan Simard looks at a curious Cold War story that has recently surfaced about seafood poison and suicide needles.
In May of 1960, Francis Gary Powers' U-2 spy plane was shot down over the Soviet Union during a high-altitude reconnaissance mission. In his pocket was a modified silver dollar containing a hidden needle loaded with a lethal dose of shellfish toxin. The subject came up in a presentation this week at the Kodiak Area Marine Science Symposium. Patricia Tester, an oceanographer, told the gathering she might know where the poison, known as saxitoxin, came from. Tester says saxitoxin causes paralytic shellfish poisoning. Basically, it paralyzes the muscles by interfering with signals from the body and can stop respiration. Tester says she learned about saxitoxin experiments from a trove of documents found in Kodiak that revealed tests on mice in the 1950s involving shellfish toxins. The documents included a contract for clams and a shipping receipt to the U.S. Army's Biological Warfare Laboratories at Fort Detrick in Maryland.
In one of the files, there was a Department of Defense contract for toxic shellfish. And this is what led to the detective journey that brought us through the Cold War history. The contract was from the Department of Defense, and it was for toxic clams, written in October 6, 1952.
The contract was for $10,000 of toxic clams, closer to $100,000 today, to be shipped to the East Coast.
And the department worked with the CIA to actually develop a replacement for the cyanide poison pill that was provided to U.S. covert agents and spies during that time.
Now, some real Cold War enthusiasts might be thinking, wait a minute, didn't the United States destroy its stockpile of biological weapons under the order of President Nixon in 1969? That's correct on paper, but in practice, the CIA had interpreted that instruction quite liberally. During a 1975 Congressional Committee investigation, the CIA admitted it had kept a small stockpile of saxitoxin against Nixon's order, and further admitted that this was the same saxitoxin that Powers had carried during his flight over the USSR. Tester says it's actually possible to save someone who has acute saxitoxin poisoning by putting them on a respirator to give the toxin time to work its way out of the body, but the amount carried in Power's needle would likely be lethal within minutes. Now, to be clear, this document doesn't determine definitively that Powers carried saxitoxin from Alaska, but Tester says that her research indicates that that's still highly probable.
There could have been another order, either earlier or later than the one I found. There could have been orders for toxic clams off the East Coast, which happened, I think, for the first time down in the Woods Hole area, in the Massachusetts area, about 1972. But that would have been, you know, pretty late in the game for them to have been doing anything like that. So to say that I know that that is exactly the origin, no, I can't say that. But it seems likely.
Powers never used his suicide needle. He was captured after ejecting from his plane and ultimately returned to the United States in a prisoner exchange about 2 years after his plane was downed. There are no other known cases where saxitoxin was used by the CIA.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs, 1-800-992-4960 or online at alaskaboat.com.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Thanks very much this week to KHNS's Mike Swayze, Liz Ruskin from Alaska Public Media, and KMXT's Dylan Simard.
Okay, that one worked.
He shut his eyes and came out on where no ship was.
Don't worry if you don't get the boat loose before.
Okay, sorry. One, two, one, two, three, four.